Members, I will now call the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Subcommittee to order. Kendall, will you please call the roll?
Chair Mello.
Here.
Vice Chair Beltran.
Here.
Representative Member Tank is excused. Representative Amnesty.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Burfield.
Here.
Representative Cross.
Here.
Representative Dunkley.
Here.
Representative Escamani.
Here.
Representative Esposito.
Here.
Representative Gonzalez Pittman.
Present.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Henson.
Here.
Representative Lopez.
Here.
Representative Plasencia.
Here.
Representative Redman.
Here.
Representative Schoaf.
Here.
Representative Temple.
Here.
Thank you, members, and by your presence, we have a quorum. Welcome, everyone, to post-secondary. Good afternoon. I know it's kind of a brisk day out there for all of us, unless you're from, it is if you're from South Florida. It's a little warmer there. Members, I ask that you all please silence your cell phones. And we have a new addition for all of you who may have noticed. And to my left, members, we have Kendall Haney. She is our new administrative assistant. Misty, who is in the back as support, is also here today. Just so you know, Kendall will be going forward our administrative assistant. Misty will be with the Education and Employment Committee and Choice and Innovation Subcommittee, while Kendall will also be working with us and the Education Quality Subcommittee, and hopefully I didn't mess that up too badly. So a little background on Ms. Haney. She is a recent graduate of Florida State University with a degree in environmental science and policy. She is also currently a student at Florida International University pursuing a second bachelor's degree in English. So everyone, if you could please give Kendall a warm welcome. Okay, members, today we have a great presentation by the Department of Education, and they will be providing a presentation on post-secondary workforce education. Presenting today will be the following: Ms. Kathy Hebda, who is the Chancellor for the Florida College System, and Mr. Kevin O'Farrell, who is the Chancellor for Division of Career and Adult Education. Chancellors Hebda and O'Farrell, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you so much for this opportunity to be here today. I'm Kathy Hebda. I'm the Chancellor of the Florida College System, and I'm here with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kevin O'Farrell, who is the Chancellor of the Division of Career and Adult Education, also at the Department of Education. And thank you for the opportunity. As I said, we have a presentation for you today that will lay a little bit of a foundation of the types of workforce education programs and credentials that are offered for post-secondary students in Florida, throughout Florida. And then after I do the foundation of the program degrees and types of certificates and awards, then I'm going to pass it to Dr. O'Farrell, who's going to talk about some of the performance of those programs and outcomes and some of the exciting programs we have going forward, even using and capitalizing on some of the federal dollars and things like that. So that's our presentation for you, Madam Chair. First, we'll start with a system overview. Certainly in, we have Florida public school districts in grades 6 through 12 who offer career and technical education programs. There are 57 of those school districts that offer post-secondary programs, either because they have a technical center or technical college, or because they also offer adult education programs. And so we'll be giving you a little bit of information on adult education today as well. And then, of course, we have 28 institutions in the Florida college system that certainly offer post-secondary education workforce programs. Also today, we want to talk about our other partners in providing access to and preparation for employment And two of those partners are the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, or VR, and also the Division of Blind Services. Those divisions join us in Career and Adult Education and the Division of Florida Colleges in the Department of Education in serving students and adults who are, with disabilities who are seeking to prepare for and engage in employment. And on this slide, we're pretty proud of the things they've been doing recently and wanted to highlight this. Many times when we talk about post-secondary education and employment preparedness, sometimes the work of these divisions and the outcomes of their clients is sometimes overlooked. It gets overshadowed by some of the regular education institutions. And so this is an opportunity just to show you some of the outcomes they've had recently. Highlighting those for you, you can see they get tremendous increases in earnings of individuals served by VR and blind services, nearly 19% increase in quarterly earnings. And these are WIOA performance measures, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. These are federal measures, and so these are things that are standard across the nation. And so these are amazing increases for Floridians that are being served by the Division of VR and Blind Services. When we think about career education across the state and how do we set up career education, there's so many opportunities. How do we organize that information for people? The first thing we do is we talk about the 17 career and technical education pathways, or clusters. These are the same as federal clusters, except that we have one extra one in Florida under energy, because that's such a big area of employment and industry in Florida. But these are how those careers are done generally across the nation. And it helps us provide individuals who are interested in career employment and education pathways, ways to think about the kinds of employment they want, the kind of job that they want, and where they can seek that kind of education opportunity and employment. So what you think about in these career clusters and pathways, too, is it gives us a way to offer sequential programs, courses and credentials that stack on each other in these individual areas. And again, helping our individuals who are looking for them make sure that they're getting those opportunities that we do, especially in combination with career and industry partners. So all of the academic programs that are prepared, the curriculum frameworks that are prepared in these clusters are with industry partners in each one of these clusters. When we think about career and credential types, what can people earn that will get them ready and available for the workforce? These are the types that we generally think of. And I'll walk you through each one of them going from left to right. The career certificate is an opportunity for an individual to earn what we call clock hour credit. So there, you think of college credit and clock hour credit. Both are things that show up on a transcript. Clock hour credits are measured by time. And skill training, that's what they're focused on. And college credit can be a combination of skill training and academic training together. But clock hour credit then, in the way we think about it in the Department of Education, also translates into or rolls up into college credit later on. So that's why those 17 career clusters are important too, because if you're earning clock hour certificates or credits in one career cluster, they can generally translate into college credit into that same career cluster or program. So that's the first opportunity for an individual to succeed. And you'll be familiar with some of those things. Automotive service technician is an example of a career certificate. Practical nursing is an example of a career certificate or clock hour certificate. And then applied technology diplomas can be layered on top of a career certificate. So if you already hold a certificate in one of those areas, a career certificate, you can earn an applied technology diploma. You can earn that diploma in additional clock hour credit or even in college credit. But it generally works with and becomes a more specialized area on top of that career certificate. Technology management, dental assisting management are the types of examples that you would see in an applied technology diploma. Most of us are familiar with the associate in science and the associate in applied science degrees, two-year degrees, that are focused on skills or career training. Before that, though, we have a college credit certificate. So while a student is earning an associate in science or an associate in applied science degree, along the way, They're also earning things called college credit certificates, which are specific areas that then roll up and stack into that AS degree, which also, not only for the student, but offers the employer a vision or some information about the kinds of specialties those students have as they move along in the Associate in Science program. So you're familiar with the RN in nursing. That's the most popular amongst at least the college system, Associate in Science degrees, but we also have Engineering Technology, which then sometimes can work up into a baccalaureate degree, Bachelor of Science in Engineering, and we certainly have a lot of AS programs in the college system in cybersecurity. And you can think of in cybersecurity where you might have lots of specific areas of certification in computer science or security along inside that AS program in cybersecurity. And then we have an advanced technical certificate, which similar to the ATD, which goes on top of a career certificate, an advanced technical certificate usually rides on top of someone who already has an associate in science degree. So you can think of a paralegal studies advanced technical certificate on top of an AS or an AA degree. Right now, just to give you an idea of how many we have of these, the two most popular completion and award types we have are the two certificate programs. Career certificates and college credit certificates, both are upwards of 200 of those that are awarded annually. The next would be about 125, close or over 120 associate in science degrees awarded, and then the applied technology diplomas and associate in applied science advanced technical certificates have smaller numbers, maybe a couple of dozen or so of those. The other workforce program that's really important to talk about when we're talking about, especially the Florida College System, are our baccalaureate degrees. Florida College System institutions are authorized to offer baccalaureate degrees in workforce education programs. And so we're not authorized to offer bachelor's of arts degrees, but only bachelor of science or bachelor of applied science degrees. And the statute that authorizes this and the State Board of Education rule that implements this requires specific need data from the Department of Economic Opportunity to show that there is a regional need for that particular occupation and baccalaureate degree to support that occupation. And so you can see that some of the numbers up here on this slide, last year, 21-22, we had about 47,000 students enrolled in our Florida College System institutions in these workforce baccalaureate degrees, and we had over 11,000 completions. And you can think of that the nice, really important thing about anything that happens in the Florida College System, because college system institutions are assigned statutorily one or more counties in Florida to be designated as their service region, and it's their mission to support the residents of that service region and the employers and communities of that service region. And so it's not surprising when you think that 90% of the graduates of these baccalaureate programs will still be employed, found employed in Florida, and many times in the same region where they were educated and lived before they started the program. And that's average salary, almost $65,000 a year. It's very good when you consider the average cost for 30 semester hours of credit at a Florida College System institution is still about $3,200. So that's a good deal. It's a great investment that the Florida legislature and the state of Florida makes in our college system on behalf of our students who reap the benefits. Some folks also ask us sometimes, well, how much enrollment is in the Florida College System is in baccalaureate programs? About 7%, 7% of our enrollment is in upper division courses in the Florida College System. So we are still primarily lower division, associate in arts, and you could see all the certificate programs that we offer. When we think about degree-seeking students, whether they're seeking a baccalaureate or associate-level degree in our college system, and you narrow the population down a little bit, it's about 9% of the students in the Florida College System, degree-seeking students that are enrolled in a baccalaureate program, and about 9% of our completers, too. The next type is registered apprenticeship. These are very, very popular right now, and we're very excited. Dr. O'Farrell is going to share some great completion and enrollment numbers with you in just a few minutes about apprenticeship programs. I think most people are familiar with them, registered apprenticeship programs, being they're registered with the state or mainly with the federal government as a program. We also have something called pre-apprenticeship programs now, where maybe the individual is not quite ready to enter a full apprenticeship program, but there's a program set up either at the secondary level or now even at the post-secondary level that gets them ready to be in that pipeline and engage with their employer in that full apprenticeship program. You can see the numbers of folks. We have 328 actual programs. The majority of those, 275, are actual apprenticeship programs. The remainder are the pre-apprenticeship programs. And as I said, Dr. O'Farrell is going to have some exciting increases in numbers to show for that. But the, probably one of the best things about an apprenticeship program is the individual gets to work while they're learning. They work on the job. There's an industry partner who's the sponsor. And then they partner with a high school, with a district, with a Florida College System institution or another entity to provide that additional training in addition to the on-the-job training. And as I said, that an individual gets to continue to earn their paycheck and move up in the system, move up in that agency while they're working or with that employer. And it works out really, really well for everyone. Continuing workforce education. This is actually defined in the statute. And these are that you can see in the green bubbles up there. These are the kinds of training you would think of someone who maybe holds a license already and needs to re-up that license. And so they go back for some continuing workforce education. That's typically what you see. It also covers, though, the kinds of employment or training for employment that many colleges engage with employers, where an employer will come to a college system institution and say, you know what, I need 60 people trained in X, the way I want X done to work at my institution or at my company. And so that would be done as fee for hire. So this is not funded by, if you count FTE for funding for the college system, continuing workforce education, those enrollments are not counted for purposes of regular FTE or fundable FTE, but it is definitely enrollment that's happening at the college system. And those fees or the cost for the training is then generally paid either by the entrants, the student who's participating, or the employer. You can see we have a lot of students enrolled in CWE courses. We have our first program inventory that we're collecting thanks to the new data collection from House Bill 1507 from a couple of years ago that's really helped us start to collect data on some things that we didn't have a lot of visibility into. But this is a really exciting area of training in post-secondary education in Florida, because so many employers and employees are helped by this kind of training. So colleges do report the courses that are taken in CWE, because you might think of the person who's renewing their license may need a course, two courses to renew that license. So we have that number for you, but we're still working on, and we'll hope to reveal soon, the inventory of the programs that are offered through CWE as well. Another very popular one, credential type in workforce education is the industry certification. We have both industry certifications and licensure on this tab, on this slide, so you can get an idea of what those two things mean. The difference with an industry certification and perhaps a college credit certificate is the industry certification requires a third-party examination to be passed. And so when you think about a CompTIA certification and some other kind of computer science certification that you might get, even if that's part of your degree program, you don't get that certification until you pass the CompTIA exam, which is done by another corporation. It's not done by the college or proctored or developed by the college. And so industry certifications, you can see they're time-limited credentials. Sometimes institutions will have courses that prepare for an industry certification, but students aren't necessarily limited. It's not like a final exam that you have to wait till you complete all courses in a program before you sit for the test. You can qualify and sit for the test because it's third party and perhaps even earn it sooner. So, as I said, third party agency. And then we're all familiar with licenses that people can earn. It's also a credential issued outside of an institution by a third party to qualify for a specific occupation. And you can see some of the examples that you're used to there: law enforcement officer, firefighter for the types of licenses, certified nursing assistant would be a license that we're very familiar with in the healthcare industry, and then things like AWS certification, I mentioned CompTIA, are the kinds of things you would think of. HVAC is an industry certification that many of us are also familiar with. Adult general education, I mentioned we're going to touch on this a little bit because it's such an important area. You hear our senior chancellor Mack and others talk about the 3 million Floridians that need to earn the equivalent of a high school diploma and better their literacy skills. And these adult ed programs are the primary way where they can do that. And so what you have here on this page is, in addition to what we would probably normally be familiar with, which is the high school equivalency or GED diploma, there are a number of other adult education programs that are offered, some in English as a second language. Some combine those programs with career readiness or career certificates, and we call those integrated education and training programs. Again, Dr. O'Farrell is going to touch on those a little bit in just a few minutes. And then even adult high school co-enrolled, so credit recovery program for enrolled high school and students. That's probably the one exception to traditional adult education, which is usually only offered to individuals who are 16 or older and are not eligible to enroll in high school. Just for informational purposes, here's our adult education program participation. The blue bar shows that the primary responsibility for adult ed is with the school districts, and the green on top is the adult education enrollment provided by Florida College System institutions. They're eligible to do that, but as I said, the primary responsibility is with Florida school districts. Some of the changes in enrollment, there was a time a number of years back when we started to charge a small amount of tuition for adult ed, and that may have had some impact on enrollment. And then, of course, the lowest year of enrollment is certainly during the pandemic, when adults just weren't able to complete their courses or remain enrolled. And I am now going to pass it to Dr. O'Farrell, who, as I said, is going to give you the exciting part of the presentation, which is all of the information about how we're doing.
Thank you, Chancellor Hebda. If you would just wait a moment, please. Yes, ma'am. I would like to give members the opportunity to ask questions on slides 1 through 12. If any members have any questions about the presentation so far, this would be a great time to ask. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the apprenticeship programs, and if you could just go through some of the potential risk and benefits to the employers that participate in those.
Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you very much. And I'll ask Dr. O'Farrell also to join me in answering this question. I'll kick it off, and he may have some additional things to add. The first thing that we think about with on-the-job training, and this is true even when I was speaking earlier about vocational rehabilitation, and even as we try to get on-the-job training, even if it's not yet the apprenticeship program for students in high school, is there is employers sometimes think about the risk of workers' compensation insurance and those kinds of things. Some of that is already taken care of in Florida statutes, so that some of those risks are already solved. I think the other thing that you might think of between the employer relationship as a sponsor and an institution who might be providing the training is just working out that partnership agreement. How much is the institution going to provide that the employer doesn't have to worry about, and who will cover the cost of that arrangement? And so I think sometimes the negotiation of how to actually put those two things together between the employer and the institution they want to partner with can take some time to work out.
We have two additional questions for Chancellor Hebda.
Okay, perfect. And I would just simply add to that, too. I think part of the challenge maybe as we expand apprenticeships and pre-apprenticeships is helping businesses that traditionally weren't in apprenticeable vocations to see the benefit of kind of reverse engineering this kind of training and developing their own pipeline. So, you know, you typically think of apprenticeship being in the construction trades, but we have been branching out into healthcare, information technology, and I'm going to share a little bit about how we're doing that also in teacher apprenticeship opportunities as well. So,
thank you, Chancellor O'Farrell. Chancellor Hebda, you are recognized. Did you have any additional questions, Representative Cross? Okay, thank you. Representative Hawkins, you are next, followed by Representative Shoaf and Representative Eskamani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to slide 5. The governor set a goal for Florida to be number one in workforce education by 2030. Would you provide a quick update on the status of that request and whether it has led to any recommendations in terms of best practices and partnerships?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been exciting work ever since that original order went out from the governor to lay down that challenge for us to meet. I say us, I mean the whole education community, workforce community, to meet that challenge. And some amazing things have happened. I will tell you that the number and the quality, I think, too, of the partnerships that, at least in the Florida College system that I have seen, our institutions make with other companies, with corporations, with businesses and industries that are looking to come to Florida. And now we're at the table in helping recruit those businesses, and our colleges are there, our universities are there, providing information of how we can help train the workers they need to bring them to the state of Florida. So, so yes, those opportunities are amazing. And I will tell you, the enrollment in a number of those workforce programs has increased in the Florida College system overall. Different programs, one by one, you know, may vary, but the overall percentage of students enrolled in the in workforce programs compared to the traditional AA program has actually increased. And so colleges have stepped up, the part in the business community has stepped up, and it's been remarkable to watch those things happen.
Chair, one more. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then on slide 7, I had a question. First of all, that's a high wage. I mean, that's impressive, the $64,000. What are some of the baccalaureate programs that have contributed to this high wage, and which institutions are offering those programs?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you. We'd be happy to get you the full list of all the programs, but I think some of the ones that come to mind are, like, we have three institutions now that are offering baccalaureate degrees in cybersecurity. And there's such a need for cybersecurity everywhere across the state. And those institutions, when they applied to make those baccalaureate degree programs, their universities were fully supportive of that. And then those baccalaureate students can continue their education in a master's program at those same universities. So it's a great partnership in cybersecurity. But that's definitely going to be an area. That, computer science. There are a lot of supervision and management programs in the college system. And the one that comes to mind, for instance, most recently, Seminole State College had an AS program already in law enforcement, like we saw. But the sheriff's office came, the police departments came and said, we need managers. We need people that can't just manage people. We need people that know policing and know all of that to then become supervisors. So can you put this program together for us that lets that happen and makes that possible? And so when you think of some of those programs, you also have people that then are in their industry already, and now they can step up and be a manager or a supervisor and rise in the ranks in that industry. So, and we have engineering technology AS programs that also then feed into those some of the supervision programs. And so they're already making a high wage with the AS degree, and that it just increases once they get their baccalaureate degree.
Definitely see your passion. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Hawkins. Representative Schoaf, you're recognized, followed by Representative Escamani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. This is great stuff. With respect to the career and technical credential types, are there any areas that we can improve or strengthen articulation agreements? I would say with applied technology diploma articulating to the award of an AS degree. Is it something like that that you could recommend improvement?
Chancellor, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that question. Articulation is an ongoing goal of ours and something we're always striving to improve. The Florida 2+2 system is still the envy of the nation. There are so many states who can't even talk about guaranteed transfer of credit from lower division to upper division like we have. And we also have spent a lot of time working on those agreements specifically in career education, like you mentioned. And the articulation of clock hour credit, which isn't college credit yet, into college credit programs. So when you think of someone who's done a clock hour certificate in welding and then wants to go to the next level of welding or a specific area of welding that requires a college level training to do that, then that credit they've already earned in welding in the clock hour system automatically transfers then, because of the state level agreement, into 9 or 12 semester hours of college credit that person doesn't have to repeat or pay for, because they've got the skill already. What they need now is that next level of skill or some additional academic training to hit that next level of employment. So I would say that we can always improve. There's some things we were doing very well, like the example I just gave. Nursing is a great example. LPN to RN to BSN is a great example. not every single career area has that clean pathway. And so we have conversations a lot about how do we get more statewide agreements that everybody would use. There are definitely agreements when institution to institution, tech center or tech college to college system institution or school district to college system institution, but we do have a goal of increasing the number of statewide agreements so that no matter where you live or where you transfer to, you get the benefit of that articulated credit.
Thank you, Representative Shoaf. Representative Eskamani, you are recognized, followed by Representative Bell.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I first just had a question that Ranking Member Tant wanted us to ask. If you would give me that opportunity, Madam Chair. She was curious about how much money has vocational rehabilitation sent back to the federal government the last 3 years. So just, she's very passionate about vocational rehab. So have we been effective in using federal dollars, or have we struggled to do that?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. A couple of things I would say. Off the top of my head, I would need to go back and look and see to make sure, did we transfer or send any money back? And if we did, how much was it? Madam Chair, we do have the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation with us today. It's at the Chair's pleasure whether you'd like him to answer a question or whether you prefer us to get the specific numbers and bring it back.
Yes, Chancellor. Please just come up. You're recognized. State your name and your title. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Brent McNeil. I'm the Director of the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. Excuse me. Representative, in this past year, the division did submit money back to the federal government from the allotment. We are not alone in that. The amount that is provided under the formula grant for vocational rehabilitation is tied to the consumer price index. And so that has increased as inflation and that index has increased. Many states have struggled thereby to keep up with that. And so there has been, this is a nationally recognized issue. In fact, the Rehabilitation Services Administration, our federal partners, are now looking to call together a task force of national vocational rehabilitation administrators to address this problem and figure out what are the legal barriers, what are the causes, and how we can best tackle that so states can best use that money.
Okay.
Chair.
Any follow-up?
I just want to say thank you to that, and I'm sure Ranking Member Tam will have talked to you more about it. So thank you
Excellent.
For that.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Awesome. And I do have just an additional question, Madam Chair, if I may.
Okay. Just a moment, please. Director McNeil, please complete an appearance card for us before you leave.
Certainly. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Eskamani, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the teachers that provide this important curriculum, I've always heard concerns, just the retention, recruitment of educators in our workforce programming, just because oftentimes some of these fields, you can actually make a better earning in the field as a practitioner versus an instructor. So I am curious, I know there's been efforts to try to increase those wages, try to recruit more teachers for the demand. What has been that experience like, and are we still facing those struggles when it comes to, especially at the county level, and be able to retain our instructors in these fields?
Chancellor, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. You probably heard, if you were here last year, some testimony about that, particularly in relation to nursing. That it's been difficult to retain the qualified nurses who also meet the qualifications to teach because they have a terminal degree in nursing education programs, for example. The same could be true when you think of computer science and the kinds of wages that individuals can earn in some of those fields. The good news I would tell you is that, again, going back to the partnerships that Representative Hawkins asked about earlier, is really, as I said, the folks have stepped up, hospitals have stepped up, and the colleges have met hospitals where they want to be. And there are now partnerships that allow the exchange, if you will, of nursing staff who can teach part-time or be relieved of some duties to actually teach at the college. They don't have to take a lower wage or lose their position at the hospital to be an educator, a nurse educator. And so there are some unique things that are happening like that that allow the college system to actually utilize the best of the best. And when it comes to workforce education, I will tell you, I've visited all of the colleges, and I take time, Chancellor O'Farrell does the same, they almost gave you a promotion to representative. Chancellor O'Farrell does the same thing. We go spend time on the campuses, not just talking to the president like we usually do. I spend lots of time with the presidents, but with their teams, with students, with the faculty, and to a person that I have met who is a faculty member or a dean of any of those programs, these are people who have been in their industry for years. And I don't mean they were in it years ago and are still teaching, but are in the middle of what they're doing. So the people that teach these programs in the Florida college system are actively a part of their industry, or maybe recently retired, but still just an amazing wealth of information, on-the-job information, not theoretical information, but on-the-job information. And so they are an incredibly valuable resource to our workforce education programs.
Thank you, Representative Escamani. Next, we have Representative Bell, followed by Representative Henson. Representative Bell, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor, for this great presentation. Career is so important, you know, to the state of Florida and our sustainability. But on slide 10, the 2022-23 CAPE list, you have over 320 certifications approved for performance funding. Which certificates are the most popular in performance and the best?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you. I would have to print the list for you to be sure I knew exactly which ones were the most popular. But I think it's interesting you asked which ones are the best, because there's definitely a rigorous process that we use, and we partner with CareerSource to make sure that certificates that are on that list are really important for students to earn. And the CAPE list has been around for a long time, and so over time we do call and folks can request new certificates to be on the CAPE list, and now it partners with the Master Credential list through the Credential Review Committee process that was started a year or two ago. And so there is definitely a really rigorous process that has to happen before a certification can even be on the list. It doesn't mean the certifications that aren't on the list a student couldn't earn. They could, but to receive performance funding, it needs to meet that process. So we'd be happy, Madam Chair, to get the list of all the certifications and provide that to you for the committee, if that's your pleasure.
Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bell. Next is Representative Henson, followed by Representative Dunkley. Representative Henson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chancellor, for such a great presentation. I think all of us are anxious now to make these programs accessible to all of our constituents in our districts. I'm very, very excited about it. The pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs, are they paid apprenticeships?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, an apprenticeship program is on-the-job training, so you are working for the employer who's the sponsor of the program, and then going through an approved and set forth training process that takes you from one level to the next of skill building.
Follow-up? You're yes. Recognized?
I have two more, if you don't mind. So I understood, being in the education profession all my life, the teaching apprenticeship. Just quickly, briefly, what does that look like?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you think of a traditional apprenticeship where someone is learning on the job, you could think of someone who might have been in the education profession already but maybe isn't a certified teacher yet, and maybe holds a bachelor's degree in something else, or maybe doesn't hold a bachelor's degree yet. Maybe they have an AA degree and they've mm-hmm. been working as a teacher's assistant for many years, and they really know the students, they know the school, they know the school system, and they've learned a lot about education on the job. And so then you would think of that just as you would think of some of the other apprenticeship programs that Dr. O'Farrell was talking about in any other industry, where while you are earning and working, then you are not only learning while you work, but there's a really important element of supervision in an apprenticeship program. We used to think of some people think of the apprenticeship programs in the trade industries, where you're a carpenter and you're working next to a master carpenter. I would think the same would apply in a teaching situation.
Thank you. So, wow, I didn't know about that, and I'd like to know more about it. I'll contact you. the career program there back in the day was a DCT program for high school students that would be able to go to school during the day and go to work half of the day. Does that still exist, or does it exist under these apprenticeships? What's happening with that?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you very much. And you can think of that, Representative Hinson, as a secondary program. And even though our presentation is mostly focused on post-secondary, then what used to be called DCT is still there. And students still can do on-the-job training. It takes a lot of different forms. I think Chancellor O'Farrell just did a presentation on a lot of that this morning with middle and high school students. And maybe when he approaches the podium, he could give you some more information about that, because there are definitely good opportunities.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hinson. I would like to remind you, members, please stick to the scope of the presentation and your questions. The next question is Representative Dunkley, followed by Representative Burfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you could recognize me for a series of questions, just three.
Thank you. You're recognized.
Thank you so much for this presentation. And I want to go back to, to our middle schoolers. So can you tell me, Chancellor, how are the decisions made by the district to offer these programs for middle schoolers?
Chancellor, if you can possibly take that question on again, Representative Dunkley, please stick to questions that are of the scope of the presentation, and we're discussing post-secondary.
Okay, thank you. But we were talking about the career theme, and so those programs, the kids who, if those programs are offered in the middle school, and how the districts look at those. I'm sorry, if that's
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Clear. Thank you, Madam Chair. So at a high level, districts would make the same decision, similar to a college. What is the need in my area? Do I have employers that want to engage in those programs that could provide safe and important learning experiences for those students? And then the same career clusters apply. We also have digital credentials, that digital certificates that students can earn in middle school. They're not industry certifications, but they get you getting ready for an industry certification. And so they are definitely pathways and opportunities for students in middle school that districts can consider, also based on the needs of their area.
Thank you. Sorry. And I'll just ask one more.
Follow-up. You're recognized.
Do we have, in regards to the vocational rehab, do we have sufficient entities that are servicing the disability sector based on the available funds? Do we have sufficient entities, I'm asking?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly, Director McNeil would be the most appropriate person to have firsthand knowledge of that if it's all right with the Chair.
Director McNeil, if you'd like to please address the question, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, capacity with our service providers is always an issue. We're looking to increase that at all times as a continuous process. I will say that it varies throughout the state in terms of the coverage that we have. As with many things, transportation is frequently an issue, and so in our rural communities, that service has been a challenge and continues to be. We work with many of our sister agencies to address that for our mutual customers. So we do have a registration process under Chapter 413 of the Florida statutes that sets forth the requirements for an organization to be able to serve the individuals that we serve. And so we certainly welcome entities and organizations that would like to serve individuals with disabilities to contact the division, and we will assist them through that registration process.
Thank you,
Director McNeil.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Burfield, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is in reference to something that Representative Bell had brought up, and you had mentioned as you responded to another question around nursing. when you are looking at the certifications and as you are collaborating with businesses, how are you determining which certifications to offer and where you're offering them? In other words, in one part of the state, there may be a specific need or demand in an area, whereas in another area, there could be a completely different demand or need that needs to be met. Could you talk a little bit about how you try and manage those based on the regions?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that question. This goes back to the partnerships again with our local institutions. Since the colleges are assigned those specific counties for their service area, that is actually their mission to make sure they are offering the things that their community members need and that their local businesses and industries need. And so that isn't something we don't, at the Department of Education, we don't necessarily tell a college to offer a specific certification if they are or aren't. That's what they do. We provide data, we look at DEO data, we have the Credential Review Committee that discusses things like that. At the same time, that is still a local decision with the college to offer and start offering a new program that might be needed in their area.
Thank you, Chancellor Hebda. Thank you, members, for all the questions on the first half of the presentation. At this time, we would like to call up Chancellor O'Farrell for his portion of the presentation. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, well, what we'd like to do is provide you all with some information relevant to some of the enrollment and completion numbers. I think Chancellor Hebda has done an excellent job of kind of giving us a level set here of where we're at in terms of particular programs. And so this will give you an opportunity to see some of the production, if you will, and enrollments in these particular areas in the post-secondary sphere relevant to what is happening in the Florida College System side and also the district post-secondary side. So the first chart that you see before you is the workforce education enrollments by sector. So all of those particular credentials that Chancellor Hebda mentioned earlier, our associate degree programs, our college credit certificates, our apprenticeships, our career certificates, our advanced technical certificates, and our adult education are before you. And what you see here is the enrollment. And so we've tried to color code this in a way so that the takeaway, you can begin to see who is actually doing the work in that particular space. For the associate degrees and the college credit certificates and the advanced technical certificates, those are exclusively in the Florida College System space and area. And you'll see with apprenticeships and our career certificates and our adult education, where we have a much stronger presence of our school districts being providers at the post-secondary level. This next chart shows you what has been our completions for those particular credential types across our Florida College System and post-district secondary district areas as well. And over the last 3 years, we've seen a 5% increase in the production and completion of these particular credentials in these particular areas. And so I want to point out a couple of things. You'll notice that the advanced technical certificates being completed exclusively the Florida College System, again, because this is a type of credential that folks who already have an AS degree or have a baccalaureate degree are participating in to get a continued advancement and skilling up as they continue through their educational employment journey. One of the areas that we're very excited about has been the growth in our apprenticeship. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later with some of the leveraged successes that we have had to really kind of showcase what's happening in the apprenticeship space, because it really is an exciting new frontier, and we're beginning to see more and more businesses out of outside apprenticeable vocations beginning to see the value of being able to have that reverse engineered training for their particular employees and establishing their own pipelines for their own workforce needs. This chart here represents the number of industry certifications that are awarded by sector and by year. So as Chancellor Hebda mentioned, we're looking at those CAPE industry certifications that are being earned by students within the Florida College System or the school district. And to kind of add a little bit extra information about what are those particular certifications that gain the most traction, you'll notice that when we look at them across the entire state, those certifications that are found within health sciences, our public service and construction fields are the ones that are producing the most certifications across the board. You'll notice for this, most of them are being earned in the Florida College System as fundable certifications. The dark blue is the Florida College System institution. The green is the school districts. And you'll notice for the year 2017-2018, there are no reported school district certifications. That's because for that year, the legislature chose not to fund the awarding of those CAPE industry certifications. So that's the 1 year that was not funded, but has been subsequently funded since then. For this last year, which was the 21-22 year, there have been about 18,867 certifications that have been awarded and funded at the post-secondary level. And there is an appropriation that is tied to these. It's $14 million for the Florida College System and about $6.5 million for post-secondary for the awarding of those particular credentials. I also wanted to show you this particular chart that shows the average annualized earning of individuals who are graduating with the particular credentials that we've outlined today, and shows you really kind of what those earnings are. We take a look at their 1 year post-graduation, and we take the highest earnings in the four quarters that we look at, and we annualize that. And you'll notice that the highest is the advanced technical certificate, about $58,915. And again, I think it's important to note that individuals who are earning that already have an associate's degree or a baccalaureate degree. So this is, again, allowing them additional revenue and incentive in their place of employment. And to the question earlier that was Representative Hawkins, you had asked about looking at the workforce baccalaureates. It's such a great outcome. You're talking about 64,000. When you think about students coming out of the Florida College System that are already employed, and so when they earn that baccalaureate degree, that is just propelling them up that salary scale within their particular organization. And particularly when we think about our nursing students who are coming out and then entering into the BSN program, right? What that does to continue to project them in their economic, social advancement. So. One thing I do want to notice or point out here, too, that I think is interesting is if you look, too, on this particular chart about apprenticeships, looking at their exit wages, over $55,000. And again, this is what we're talking about, the value of the earn while you learn model in which individuals can enter into an apprenticeship program. And they may be coming from a pre-apprenticeship program that feeds into that. And then they have that entry wage. And then as they progressively move through the apprenticeship program, they're getting increases in their salary and composition or in compensation until they're exiting, with the average being about $55,000. So a great way to incentivize individuals to getting into much in-need workforce areas. What we want to do now is just provide you all with a overview of some of the new program successes that we have looked at over the last few years here with the department. The first is our Prepping Institutions, Programs, Employers, and Learners through Incentives for Nursing Education, or Pipeline. This was passed by the legislature last year that allocated $20 million for our tech centers or our technical colleges, an additional $40 million for Florida College System institutions. And this provides incentive fundings based on criteria on how individuals are doing by program and how they do on the NCLEX, which is the exit exam they take for their certification for nursing. And so we have several criteria with that, and one of those is the first-time passage rate relevant to how nurses perform. And we also have a category known as excellence in the calculation that describes how institutions, their nursing students, are performing above the national average. And I just wanted to share that for the NCLEX rates for the RN and associate, we have 22 Florida College System institutions that exceeded the national average in this last year. And for our practical nursing program, the LPN, we had 8 Florida College System institutions that exceeded the national average, and 11 technical colleges that exceeded the national average. So we're very proud of that and being able to provide additional resources to those institutions as they continue to develop and train those nurses for those in-demand fields. The other program we wanted to share with you is our Linking Industry to Nursing Education. This is the LINE Fund, and this provides a dollar-to-dollar match with institutions, Florida College System institutions, post-secondary, CIE, and ICUF institutions, where there is a healthcare provider that will put forward funds and the state will match them on a dollar-to-dollar basis. And there's $19 million that have been appropriated for this. And we had this last year 26 institutions partnering with 30 healthcare providers. Of that, 16 Florida College System institutions, 8 ICUF institutions, 1 CIE, and 1 school district were able to participate in this matching fund. And the medium award amount was about $292,500. And our institutions are able to then use these funds for a variety of purposes relevant to training nursing education. We know right now that the majority of those are going to go towards funds in nursing simulation centers and also student scholarships. So another great project that the legislature was able to fund this year. Our Open Door Grant is also another program that really has been able to provide additional financial resources for rapid credentials, particularly when you have a clock hour program that does not meet the federal financial threshold for funding. So if it doesn't meet 600 hours and it's less than $600, it would not qualify for federal financial aid. But the Open Door program comes in with additional funds to help with that rapid credential training. And so we have had this last year about $15 million allocated for our career centers and $20 million for our Florida College System institutions. Our Pathways to Career Opportunity Grants, or PCOG, has been the primary way that we have funded the expansion of our pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship programs. And really want to, again, thank the legislature for the funding of this program. This is open to institutions in the Florida College System, our district of post-secondary schools, and our career centers and technical centers. And this provides an opportunity to really expand what we're doing in the registered apprenticeship space. As Chancellor Hebda mentioned, we currently have, actually it's over 328 because we just had a couple more that got registered in terms of our apprenticeship programs, but about 275 apprenticeship programs, 53 pre-apprenticeship programs. And last year in our PCOG, we were able to use those funds to create 42 new apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs and served an additional 3,225 apprentices and pre-apprentices for the total of just over 17,000 that are in those programs now. So this has been a wildly successful program. We're really excited about where this is going to go for us in the future as well. And as we think about opportunities, we've been talking about expanding apprenticeship opportunities in the teacher education space. We have had, and I'll talk about the grant at the very end, there was a federal grant that we leveraged this year for apprenticeships and pre-apprenticeships known as ERAP, the Expanding of Registered Pre-Apprenticeship or Apprenticeship Programs. And in that, one of the awardees was the University of Florida. And so we have been working with them for the development of the first post-baccalaureate apprenticeship model and also a pre-baccalaureate apprenticeship model right now. And so the idea is targeting paraprofessionals within school districts so that they can receive the kind of on-the-job training through the apprenticeship program that will eventually result in the conferring of a degree. On the post-baccalaureate, it would be a master's degree. On the pre-baccalaureate, it would be by a Florida College System institution or an SUS institution conferring that degree as well. So that is an exciting opportunity that we're coming as we leverage those forward. Speaking of leveraging those federal funds, a couple of programs we just want to highlight for you and give you some information about how we have used these to continue to strengthen the CTE workforce development pipeline, if you will. The first is our Get There Faster Career Dual Enrollment Pathways expansion, and this was about $26.5 million that was designed to work with school districts to provide pathways that lead to credentials of value in the post-secondary sphere. This was designed to have school districts partner with at least one post-secondary institution. It could be one of the Florida College System colleges, it could be one of our tech colleges, it could be one of our SUS institutions to really drive that pipeline and that development and rapid credentials. The second is our civic literacy, our career pathway and civics program and curriculum. This was about $6.5 million, and this is designed to develop career academies in the K-12 space to prepare students who are interested in eventual public service, public administrative careers. And this was an award that was given to Polk State College and subsequently awarded to the State College of Jacksonville, as well as Broward College. And they're in the process right now of creating those for those academies to open this fall in 2023. We also have the Future Florida Critical Workforce Needs. This was $9 million that was awarded to St. Pete College, to South State South Florida State College and Daytona State College as well. And this was designed to, again, work with students with the establishment of academies that will allow those students to enter into workforce programs that will result in an industry certification in either healthcare, education, law enforcement, logistics, or emergency management. Three more programs to highlight for you as well is our Early Career Technical Education College Training. This was $10 million that has been awarded to St. Pete College, Miami-Dade College, Northwest Florida State College, Santa Fe College, and Tallahassee Community College as well. And this has been designed to establish collegiate high schools or expand collegiate high school offerings at those particular institutions. So St. Pete College and Northwest Florida have already added and expanded their collegiate high school programs to include ninth grade and to also provide a variety of career-focused education options. For Santa Fe and Miami-Dade, they have received authorization from their school district to open their collegiate high school and will be doing so beginning in the fall of this year. And then TCC is the first college that is going to take advantage of being the authorizing sponsor of a charter school that will also open in fall of 2023 this year. The cybersecurity and IT pathways expansion is about $21 million that have been used to expand pathways and opportunities across the state in cybersecurity, with the award going to the University of South Florida and being subbed out to fund about over 20 projects actually statewide relevant to the establishment of CTE pathways, curriculum, and partnerships across the state. So again, trying to strengthen those pipelines, understanding that there are a wonderful amount of jobs that students can take advantage of when they get in that pipeline and they are geared towards that particular area. And then, as I mentioned earlier, the apprenticeship expansion grant, the ERAP grant, which was the $12 million, which we used to expand apprenticeships across the state, awarding 11 different projects for that, one of those being the teacher apprenticeship program that I mentioned earlier. And what we wanted to do for you all, too, is just to provide a very quick overview of what have been some of our outreach efforts relevant to our workforce education campaigns. Back in September of 2020, we started at the department the kind of rebranding or reimaging of a career in technical education under the brand Get There. And I'm just so excited to announce that when you look at our numbers, to speak earlier to the question about the status of where Florida is in terms of being the number one state in workforce education, we are excited to report, and I was able to do this this morning to your colleagues in the Senate, is to announce that we have nearly 800,000 students enrolled in CTE programs at the secondary level, and about 380,000 students in the post-secondary level, with 17,000 students involved in apprenticeship or pre-apprenticeship programs. So we're continuing to see great enrollments and advancements in these areas, and part of that is that rebranding and outreach for people to understand that there are a tremendous amount of pathways that exist that don't require four-year university degrees. And that information we want to get into the hands of parents and students so they can see those viable opportunities for them. And Get There has been really the kind of the parent brand for that. And before you, you'll see these images. These represent a lot of the assets that we have relevant to the campaign. On the first, you can see some of our social media elements that we have that are used, as well as advertisements that we have of bus stations across the state. In the middle, we have flyers and information in both English and Spanish, and we're looking to expand that into Creole as well, so that you can have those resources as a local educational agency promoting your CTE programs. And then we also have our website, Get There Florida, that also houses an opportunity for individuals to kind of start their search and to see what options are available to them in terms of CTE enrollment. We're in the process right now of doing all of our ad buys and display ads that are across all of our social media platforms and Google search, also our advertisements at bus centers and depots. So we're excited about that. That started in January the 13th, and we'll run through April the 23rd for Get There. So it'll also cover CTE month, which is coming up next month, February. As a campaign within a campaign, we began to see that there was a need to get this information not just to the general public, but specifically to the individuals that we were calling the influencers, right? And I'm not talking about social media influencers, although we always like it when they push that as well. But thinking about parents, guardians, grandparents, those individuals that are helping students make a decision about the career pathway that they're interested in taking. Guidance counselors, making sure that those school counselors have the information so that when they're meeting with students, they can share with them the non-traditional academic paths that exist as well. And so in doing that, we created a partnership with CareerSource Florida and the Florida Chamber of Commerce to do the Future of Work Florida. And this particular campaign has a couple of elements in it. First, we have an action toolkit that is specifically designed for business. It has newsletters, it has email templates, it has social media tools that they can use to help push out through their channels to make their audiences aware of particular pathways, CTE pathways that would exist that would lead to jobs that would benefit them as employers and businesses. We also have a parent toolkit or checklist that parents can download, and they will be able to work with their student on career exploration, career planning, and career preparation, because it's important that parents have those resources as well as they're having conversations with their students. And then, of course, we have our website, The Future of Work Florida, where we also have a repository of videos, because we know that students will often listen with their eyes. And so we have taken various videos and worked with industry partners to put the particular job, the entry-level wage that they have, and the kind of credential that is needed to for them to acquire in order to have that particular job, and put that in a way that is visually stimulating and engaging for them. And we're also currently working on this campaign with the development of what we're calling a summit in a box. And this is an idea of being able to have a tool that can be sent out throughout the state in various regions to have conversations, talking to our local school districts, having our Florida College System institutions at the table, having our local career source boards, our chambers of commerce, our technical centers, our technical colleges, our local college access networks, our economic development boards as well, having those community conversations about what the future of work is and being able to work together in a collaborative way to have that conversation to drive people through those particular pathways that we know will lead to those high-skill, high-wage, in-demand jobs. And then finally, we have our newest campaign that is coming online, and that is the Your Way Adult Education campaign. And so with this, we knew that the adult education space is very important and can sometimes be overlooked. And if we're not careful, we could realize that there are all kinds of individuals who need basic skills, basic education. And with our IET programs, we can push them through the talent development pipeline, our workforce development pipeline. And in doing so, we want to reach them in a way that speaks to them and what adult education has to offer. And that is the Your Way. As you see, it kind of has a sister feel, if you will, to the Get There campaign. So you can see them together, Get There, Your Way. Understanding that there are three basic components with what we're trying to accomplish with Your Way. Orange serves as that primary color for the overall GED, high school kind of completion feel. The green focuses on our ESOL, which incidentally is our largest adult education program enrollment at various levels. You have some people who are learning basic English, but you have some who are well-established within their field, but they need more technical language acquisition, and so ESOL helps them with that. And then we also have our BOO with our GED and IET. And so we are in the process right now of developing our action toolkit that we will be able to put together and send that out to our local educational agencies to continue strengthening that message, the Get There, the Future of Work Florida, and the Your Way. And with that, Madam Chair, that concludes our presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chancellor O'Farrell, for that presentation. Members, do we have any questions? Okay, I see Representative Escamani, followed up by Representative Schoaf, and then Hinson. Escamani, you are recognized.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I just have two quick questions, and thanks for the presentation as well. I'm just curious, what's the average way that students pay for these programs? I'm hearing great sponsorship opportunities and apprenticeship opportunities. Are there a population of students that like do financially struggle to maintain the program? I know the goal is to keep the cost down. Maybe just some more perspective from the experience of a student when they are looking for a program. What are their cost options? And then is transportation ever a challenge just because we don't really have public transit in our state?
Sure.
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Yes, excellent question. Depends on the program and the institution to which the student is enrolling. So for instance, if they're going to the traditional Florida College System institution, if they're going to one of the post-secondary, there is financial aid packages that are available for them based on what that program is. But to your point, there have been programs, and this is where I think there's a benefit in the Open Door program, where there may be a particular program that's offered that doesn't qualify for financial aid, or maybe there's not an institutional aid package to help them. There have been, depending on what that program is, allows for the covering of that program so that student can move forward and complete that particular credential. If a student is enrolled in an apprenticeship program, there is in statute that the student cannot be assessed tuition and fee. So here you have a particular student in an apprenticeship program that is employed, that is learning and earning and not paying any related technical instruction costs. So, and then you see the chart that I'd put up on the annualized wages. They're not having to pay any tuition and fees. They're not accumulating any of that debt, but they're also starting out with $55,000 average. So that's a pretty exciting opportunity. And, you know, most of our local educational institutions, our Florida College System institutions, they work with their foundations to provide assistance with students when there are transportation issues, when there are food insecurity issues, when there are necessary and needed wraparound services that can support them in their educational journey. So that's where that delivery really does take place.
Yes, you're recognized, Representative Escamani.
Thanks so much, Chair. The certification process, for example, passing different exams, I remember reading some challenges that we face more with the for-profit institutions than the state college system with nurses, that Florida doesn't have the best passes rates in some of these certifications, specifically for the nursing pathway. But I'm curious, can you speak more to specifically the nursing certification and just what is Florida's passes rate compared to other states and what are we doing to be competitive in that area alongside any other certification experiences where students, they do the program but then cannot actually do the work until they pass XYZ exam. You know, what does that pathway look like and how do we rank with other states as well?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you. A great question. And we actually have our nursing report, which we can provide that to the committee as well, so you can look into that. When you look at the performance of institutions, public institutions, so our Florida College System institutions, our SUS institutions, you look at our post-secondary district, they perform very well. And those students, as I mentioned before, even in the development of the pipeline, are exceeding the national average on that. So where you're seeing more of the challenge and the struggle are more in the private proprietary institutions, which is become much more of a challenge in that area. So particular to that, we think that we've been doing a good job and a strong job in helping to prepare nurses for passaging in the NCLEX and then preparing for the field.
Follow-up, Representative Escamani.
One quick follow-up, if I may, Chair.
Recognized.
Thank you so much. What is the, when a student is choosing, do I go to the independent university, independent college, or a state program, what are some of the, you know, incentives or competition, if you will, that a student balances in saying, I'm going to go to, you know, this program that I see all the commercials for versus the program at my state college? Like, what are some of those competing factors, and is it, you know, is it a collaborative environment or is it competitive? And maybe just kind of speak to why a student chooses one over the other.
You recognize, Chancellor?
I think that's a good question. I think there's could be a lot of answers to that as to why a particular student would choose one particular institution over another. I can tell you that when you look at the Florida College System enrollments, when you look at post-secondary institution enrollments, they have full seats, they have full cohorts. And so that typically is the first choice for students. And if, you know, they aren't able to get their first choice, then they look for other options as well. I don't want to speak as if it's definitive, but that could be, I think, some very important information that a student will consider when they are thinking about the local educational agency they're choosing.
Thank you, Representative Escamani. Representative Shove. You are next, followed by Representative Henson. Representative Shoaf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The legislature provided $15 million this fiscal year for the Pathways to Career Opportunities Grant. Roughly 17,000 participants, I believe, from the data that you've provided us between apprenticeships and pre-apprenticeships. Figures are great, but I just wanted to get your thoughts, if there's any way that we can grow these programs or increase these numbers with what you've got so far. Yeah.
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that question. Part of our legislative budget request for this year for the department includes an increase of $5 million in our PCOG grant, with five of that going towards the development of the teacher apprenticeship models that I had mentioned earlier. So we're really excited about what that opportunity can have for us. We know that there are many more asks and opportunities than we have available funding when it comes to apprenticeships. We're only able to fund a small portion of those. So we hope that there is continued opportunity to grow and expand and to continue to move into apprenticeable occupations that are not traditionally thought of as apprenticeships. In fact, today I can tell you that at Atlantic Technical College in South Florida, today we're having our healthcare accelerator, apprenticeship accelerator program. So trying to bring in more industry partners within the healthcare field for them to see that apprenticeship becomes a viable opportunity for them. So the more that we can continue to do that recruitment and outreach to those non-traditional apprenticeable occupations, we'll really kind of begin to build the pipeline. And what I think is always so good about those particular accelerators is that we bring in businesses who have actually taken the dive, that have jumped in and have established that registered apprenticeship, and the benefits that they speak of are really compelling for their business partners. So we're continuing to get that message out. We're continuing to look to expand into those fields, and we appreciate the legislature's support of our PCOG program over the last few years.
Follow-up, Representative Shoaf, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last question. Don't mean this to be a curveball, but I wanted to get your feel, if you're able to answer. When we're looking at institutions that are utilizing state dollars for these programs, does the department have an acceptable rate for these programs, their passage rate? Do you have a certain percentage that you feel is acceptable, that they're doing a good job with these dollars and these programs? And what would that percentage be?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
That's a good question. I think one of the things that I might mention is we are in the process right now of going to be entering into rule development for our CTE audit, which was part of 1507, which will allow us the opportunity to provide performance feedback on institutions that are in need of improvement and also let those institutions know the improvement that they are doing. And then subsequently, if they need to be placed in a performance improvement plan, they could be done. So we're in the process of looking through that and establishing what some of those benchmarks could be for those kinds of performances. So that is something that we are working on and getting ready to implement.
Thank you, Representative Shoaf. Representative Henson, you are up, followed by Lopez Cross Beltran. Representative Henson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank all of you for bringing this valuable information to us. I've already posted your GetThereFlorida.com on my social media. The EREP, can individuals access that program, or do they have to go? How is it accessed?
Sure. So the EREP program will actually wrap up this year. That will be the end of that particular federal leveraging. And so the funds are awarded to the local educational institution or the college system. So those are, and we can get you a list of those that were awarded in the last ERAP allocation. And so individuals who are interested in participating in those apprenticeships will have to work with, and they usually have offices set up that can help them with the apprenticeship becoming an apprentice, because those apprentices, remember, are hired by the particular business, right? So they can help. We can help direct them and coordinate that individual. But that is really an employer-driven program, and the funds are used for the related technical instruction that is dispersed to the local LEAs.
Follow up. You're recognized, Representative Henson.
Thank you. Two more, if I may. How is pay determined for apprentices? Is it the pay that a regular person with the appropriate certification, or is there some kind of, I don't know. How is the pay determined for apprentices?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Yeah, that is actually established by the employer.
My final question, are the grants that you have, like the Open Door grant and there was another grant, are they open to organizations or just to, you mentioned career centers and institutions?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Yes, those are actually awarded, depending on the award, they're awarded to the local educational agencies, so the Florida College System Institution, the post-secondary institution. On apprenticeship, it may be a sponsorship program, so it's to the particular institution or organization that then, depending on the nature of that, can be awarded to students who are in particular programs that meet the qualifications.
Thank you. Madam Chair, could we get their contact information for more?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Henson. Representative Lopez, you're up next, followed by Representative Cross. You are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, I've been talking to my folks in Miami-Dade. That's where I represent. We still have a pretty severe nursing shortage. And I guess my question is, with the LINE program, are all college students, is that program available to all college students or just to some?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Yeah, yes. So the LINE program is a matching program. So the institution that is applying for the dollar-to-dollar match, they apply for that and receive, you know, they take the money from the healthcare provider, and that's matched by the state. And then it's used how the institution has decided it's going to be used when they have submitted their grant application. So like I mentioned, most of them are going to be using the funds for developing nursing simulation centers or scholarships. So it really becomes a question of how the local institution would use the funds in that particular program.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as a follow-up, I was told that some there are some schools that participate now in tuition programs, but not this one. Is that true?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Yeah. So this would actually be a kind of grant program. So it was a competitive grant. You would apply to receive funds based on the allocation. So it would be up to the institution if they want to participate. But in order for the institution to participate, they have to have a matching gift from a healthcare provider. So perhaps it's a hospital or nursing home or some other health provider says, we're going to give X amount of dollars to you, and then the state would match that dollar for dollar for the intent of what the applicant has put forward in their grant application.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lopez. Representative Cross, you're recognized, followed by Vice Chair Beltran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Lopez, for starting this discussion on the nursing. This is something that is critical, I know, across the state, but also in my district in Pinellas County. Really appreciate the presentation and all that you're doing to brand this, to rebrand this, and get this out to students and parents and counselors. Related to the LINE program, my question was about how the funds were allocated. It sounds like it was this competitive grant program, but did you find that there was additional need and additional applications that you could not meet with that $19 million last year?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Yeah, we went through the process and we were able to fund most of the requests, not always at the level that they had wanted to be funded because there's a limited amount of funds that are available for that. But I do anticipate that this being the first year of the program, as more individuals become aware of this and other institutions see this, that there will be increased demand and an increased desire to participate in this particular program. So I do anticipate that being a future issue.
Follow up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this may be different for individual school districts, but do you know how the budget for some of these apprenticeship programs and the career certifications and general education would come from a school district budget?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Sure. Well, there are four major areas that fund CTE at the secondary level. We have FEFP, right? So approximately $300 million are funding for CTE program. Then we have the FEFP performance, which is the CAPE industry certification. So students who earn those CAPE industry certifications, there's funding for that. The last year, 21-22, was about $68 million, but we just received on Friday, the total awards that will be for 22-23, that's going to be approximately $81 million. So that kind of brings us back in line with pre-pandemic levels. And then we have, of course, the PCOG grant that school districts are able to use, and primarily in the pre-apprenticeship space for the school districts. That's been about $1.4 million. And then the other area of funding that we have is, of course, in our Perkins funding. So Perkins 5, which is a federal formulaic calculation that provides funds to districts based on population that allows them to fund their CTE program. And so when it comes to CAPE, you know, that performance funding is used to fund those CTE programs, with 80% of that going back into CAPE. All of it actually goes back into CAPE, but 80% being used on equipment for training, instruction. The one thing CAPE cannot be used on is supplanting or using funds to pay teacher salaries or classrooms, things that could normally be covered in their operating budget. So then from those areas, school districts do have the latitude to fund the particular programs that they want relevant to CTE, the establishment of career academies that have career-themed courses that end in industry certifications, being responsive to their local community, knowing that there may be particular programs that are of interest because of certain industry clusters that are there regionally, may not be somewhere else. So it does give latitude for them to make that decision.
A follow-up?
Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And last question. So would a shift towards additional vouchers or some of the educational savings account, do you think, how would that potentially impact a school district being able to provide some of these apprenticeships or certifications or adult education?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
I think that would be something for this committee to perhaps consider and to review at this time. I would not want to necessarily speak on that or feel qualified at this point, but would certainly welcome, you know, your all's deliberation in that.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Cross. Representative Beltran, Vice Chair of Beltran, you're on deck.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I want to go back to the PCOG grant program for a minute. So these programs, I guess, they're being expanded or created through these grants, and then I guess it's the obligation of the sponsor to pay for the ongoing instruction. Is that my understanding so far correct on that?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Yeah, so with the PCOG, you know, you have basically, you know, from an apprenticeship, you have three components, right? You have the sponsor, you have the employer, and you have the related technical instruction. So the employer will often establish relationships relevant to the RTI in terms of, you know, that arrangement is worked out on a local level. But to your point, yes, if the PCOG funds were not there, it would be the responsibility of the employer to continue with the funding opportunities for the related technical instruction in this, or even with the sponsor for that particular program.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that answer. So I guess my question is there a standard rate to pay for this, the ongoing instruction by the sponsor, or is that negotiated ad hoc?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
That would be something that would be worked out at the local level.
One more follow-up. You're recognized, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair. So in addition to the technical instruction, I guess how many hours of on-the-job training do these programs require, and is there any provision in state or federal law to deviate from those requirements if there is some critical or high-demand worker shortage that arises that we need to get folks into jobs faster?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
For apprenticeships, it's the equivalent of 2,000 hours. So one way of thinking about it is 2,000 is a standard that would basically say that if this individual were to receive on-the-job training, it would take them about 2,000 hours to acquire the skills necessary to be a functioning full employee. Or it can be 12 months if it's a competency-based program.
Thank you, Vice Chair Beltran. Next, we have Representative Redman, followed by Representative Esposito. Representative Redman, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. I wanted to go back to the line fund, if we can. Obviously, it's created to incentivize collaboration, you know, between the nursing ed programs and healthcare partners. But specifically, would you mind giving us a few examples of those partnerships that have been formed and received line funding? Thank you.
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Sure. Thank you. Some of those have been with our hospitals. Hospitals have partnered with Florida College System institutions to develop and increase the workforce. So I mentioned earlier simulation centers, right, which are very important because we know that when it comes to instruction, having the clinical space can be very limiting, right? And so the ability for a Florida College System institution or even a post-secondary institution to have an enhanced clinical space really helps with the acceleration and the challenge of having the clinical site. They can do it in the simulation space. So we have seen those particular partnerships. As I mentioned before, the median award is about $292,000. But there have been some that have been a multi-million dollar award. Just depends on how much funds the healthcare provider wants to put forward in the matching fund program.
Follow-up? Okay. Thank you, Representative Redmond. Representative Esposito, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a few questions about the Open Door Grant. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there are many students who are in the programs. Can you talk a little bit about how many students that are enrolled in programs are eligible for the Open Door Grant, and are there any kind of barriers to entry there?
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Yeah. We can definitely provide you a more detailed report. We've just finally completed that relevant to Open Door. We've had some changes to the program to increase its accessibility. So one of the things that we have done most recently is we've removed the need for the FAFSA completion so that the aid can be directly issued to the student regardless of filling out that financial aid, as well as extending the hours of the particular program. So now this will cover programs up to 1,350 hours, which is an expansion. And so we are also in the process now of, at the post-secondary level, adding additional credentials to our master credential list and to the CAPE list. In doing so, we believe that this then will allow for more institutions to offer programs relevant to what is on the MCL and eligible for post-secondary funding to continue to drive student enrollment in that particular programs.
Follow-up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So the increasing the accessibility is fantastic. What types of programs are you doing to create awareness, and is there a per-student cap?
You're recognized, Chancellor. Yeah.
So the student can receive up to, I believe, $3,000, if that's what you're talking about in regards to how much money they can receive through Open Door individually. And, of course, we're trying to, through our Get There campaign and our Future of Work Florida, to drive individuals into those short-term rapid credentials that can be as little as, 20 weeks to as far as 2 years, but more in that 20-week kind of program, because we know that that really will accelerate an individual when you think about those who are laid off, displaced workers, being able to get them into a rapid program that gets them a credential as quickly as possible that gets them reemployed is really kind of the goal. So targeting those kinds of areas, always transportation, logistics industry is a high demand right now. So that's where we're kind of pushing some of our attention.
Thank you, Representative Esposito. And it looks like our last question is from Rep. Amnesty. You're
recognized. Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, if we can go to slide 6, I have a quick question regarding the programs. Out of these programs that we have, I see 5, what program does not qualify for financial aid because it does not meet the federal level of standards considering higher ed?
Let me get to...
You're recognized, Chancellor.
And your question is on this particular slide, right? So it would not necessarily be the credential type, but it would actually be a program within a credential type, anything that's a program that's less than 600 hours. So if it reaches 600 hours, then it qualifies for federal financial aid. If it's below that, it does not.
Follow-up?
Based on these programs, which are above the 600 credit hour?
Oh, so these would be, in college credit certificates, there are multiple programs. So they have multiple, you may have, CDL, which is 320 hours, right? So CDL would not be on there. But you can also have a career credit certificate like cosmetology, which is, 1,250 hours. So it depends on what that particular program is as to whether or not it qualifies. So when it comes to hours, it's on the clock hour side. So that's when we're talking about our career certificate programs.
Did Any further questions? Okay, thank you, Representative. Seeing no further questions, I would like to thank both Chancellor Hebda and Chancellor O'Farrell for your valuable presentation. We have many new members on the committee this year, so thank you both for your presentation today. Members, thank you all for being engaged. Great questions today. And that concludes today's agenda. Seeing no other business before the subcommittee, Representative Hinson moves, we rise. Meeting adjourned.